Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and thanks for tuning in to this New Books Network podcast. My name is Catriona Gold. I'm a PhD candidate at University College London. Today, I'm very excited to be interviewing Ethan Blue about his new book, The Deportation Express, A History of America Through Forced Removal, which came out with the University of California Press in October 2021. Ethan Blue is a senior lecturer in history at the University of Western Australia. He specializes in US history, prison studies, and immigration history. His new book offers a history of the United States' systematic expulsion of undesirables and immigrants, told through the lives of the passengers who were transported out of the US via deportation trains. This is a fascinating and very readable book, which I highly recommend picking up a copy of. So without further ado, welcome to the podcast, Ethan.
Thanks very much. Glad to be with you.
Great. So we usually like to start by asking our authors to tell us a bit about themselves and their academic trajectory. So what have you been working on up to now leading up to this book? How did you come to write the book? And, you know, sort of how does it connect with that previous work? I'd love to hear more about that.
Yeah. Absolutely. Well, first off, I just want to acknowledge that I am on unceded Wajuk Noongar Buja, speaking to you from Perth, Western Australia, but this is unceded Noongar land and sovereign land. And sovereignty has never been ceded, and I don't think sovereignty can really be ceded in this settler colonial situation. I come originally from, you know, my family's from Europe. We were migrants to the United States. I grew up in Coast Miwok country in what is known as Northern California these days. And traveled around quite a bit, did my undergrad degree in Virginia, went to grad school at the University of Texas. And in Texas, I started studying the history of prisons. Actually, initially wanted to study the history of cross-border labor organizing. This was when the North American Free Trade Agreement was being passed. And so I had a real interest in migration of capital and migration of people, and then how labor could mobilize and organize across borders too. But while I was poking around in the archives, I learned that prisoners had been used to build the Texas state capitol in the 1880s. And the notion, and this was during Reconstruction, so when the children of freed slaves are when the children of freed slaves were criminalized for essentially nonsense reasons, and then were used to build a monument to state authority. This was absolutely fascinating to me, and this was really a turn for me towards beginning to investigate the carceral state. So the modes of punishment, of criminalization amongst, particularly against people of color and working class folks writ large. And always having it be connected to borders too. And so that was my kind of first foray into this. I then wrote my first book, which was called Doing Time in the Depression, Everyday Life in Texas and California Prisons. And this was a really close read, kind of like thick description of everyday life in these two borderland prisons during the 1930s. And so in that book, I was trying to really understand the experiences of punishment and the complexities of racial gender formations and how punishment related to forms of political economy, right? So with mass unemployment and the Depression, but also going with the rise of the New Deal social welfare state, what was going on behind prison walls? And so that book looked at arriving in each prison, so kind of the demography of incarceration. Then the middle part of the book looks at everyday life, so the kinds of labor prisoners were doing, the development of prison athletics and cultural programming and prison radio shows, overt and covert forms of authority, so the ways that guards and prisoners interact differently in each system. So the California system also is based on like the factory model and the big house model, whereas the Texas system is based on the plantation as its model, and seeing how these give rise to different kind of carceral modernities based around geography and history. And then the book closes with the experience of leaving the prison, either on parole or through death. And so that was my first major project. But then as I was doing that work, you know, I was digging through the archives about parole, and I came across records of people who were being, you know, quote, paroled for deportation. And this was totally fascinating to me, because what it was indicating was that a non-citizen could leave the increasingly fortified, militarized spatial containment of the prison, right? As long as they were willing to leave the fortified, militarized, spatialized confines of the nation, okay? And so again, these connections between incarceration and locking people in and deportation and locking people out, this was starting to emerge for me as a really interesting set of, well, really profoundly troubling, but really interesting set of questions around the United States as an imperial, racially structured, you know, capitalist state. And then actually following on from there, I was doing some research into this prison doctor. And this guy was named Leo Stanley. This doctor was doing these quite horrific testicular implantation experiments on prisoners at San Quentin. And I was doing research on his medical experimentation, and I found his journals and his diaries. And so Leo Stanley would ride these trains, and he thought it was really fun. He kept these detailed notes of his journeys. This combined two of his great loves, which was eugenics. And you know, the so-called the biological protection of the nation from so-called unfit people. But he was also a really keen traveler. So he got to ride these deportation trains and you know, ethno-racially purify the nation in his vision and go on a fun trip. And so this is when the project really started to take shape for me.
Okay, great. That's a really good lead into where we're going to go with this interview. I think the way that you look at these particular sort of figures, so both, you know, you've got the bureaucrats, the guards, and also the deportees, in the book is really compelling, in the way you sort of tell these broader histories through their stories. And so I guess a good way, before we start getting into those in more depth, perhaps a good way to start getting into the book would be to ask, well, what were the deportation trains? So what are the trains? What are the routes they cover? When did they come about, and how long did they last? And sort of who were they deporting, broadly speaking? I think that would be a good entry point into understanding this book for our listeners.
Thanks. Yeah, well, I guess to really get at it, you need to try to back up to the ways that the first sort of kinds of immigration restriction that the U.S. was really embracing was around trying to stop people from coming in. So around the host of anti-Asian immigration laws that develop, you know, from the 1870s and really pick up speed with the Chinese Exclusion Act in 1882, the Geary Act in 1892, and all of the acts that continue on through the 1920s. But these acts very rarely defined, well, they focused on stopping people from coming in, but they very rarely defined how to kick people out who are considered undesirable, who are already within the country. And so this was a real weak link in the creation of this sort of carceral, regulatory, anti-immigrant state that was being developed. And so there was never enough money that was being appropriated for this. The systems of removal were usually very locally driven. They were very expensive. They were ad hoc. And they were not systematized. And so by 1914, some bureaucrats within the Immigration Bureau are deciding that actually, you know, we need to have more rationalization of governmental processes. And there, interestingly, there's some real elements in here of Washington, D.C.-based bureaucrats who are trying to control the labor processes of various regional immigration bureaus and trying to keep their costs down. And so what they decide is they would do experiments with having centrally organized deportation trains. And so they drew on the economy of the rail. You know, this is the exemplary technology of industrial modernity, right? To try to keep down governmental costs for expulsion, to systematize it, and then send these trains on basically constant circuits through the country. And so starting in 1914, and then really running through the Second World War, these trains would make constant circuits around the U.S. And they would, the journey I kind of describe in the book starts off in Seattle, and then it stops in Portland and San Francisco, Denver, Chicago, Buffalo, and then New York. And it goes along the way and is picking up people who are gathered from across the Atlantic world. And it stops for non-citizens who have been convicted of any number of supposed offenses. So if somebody has been convicted of a crime, then they are now rendered deportable because this, you know, is considered a violation of the immigration law, and they're no longer welcome. If somebody is simply very, very poor, then they can be retroactively, and is collecting welfare, they can be retroactively deported as having been likely to become a public charge. If somebody has a cognitive difference or a physical disability, same thing, they can be deported. Or somebody's a political radical, they can be deported too, again, as something that is considered a deportable offense. So anyway, the train stops in New York, and all of these people from across the who have been gathered from these various carceral institutions, carceral welfare institutions, they're loaded on a steamship at Ellis Island and sent across the Atlantic to Liverpool, Le Havre, Naples, and beyond. Now, at this point, and I try to trace the journeys of those folks, the transatlantic journeys. At this point, the train then turns around and it makes the westbound journey. And I mean, they basically make stops wherever the immigration authorities in Washington, D.C. say or tell the deportation agents the train should stop. So in the one that I trace, they stop in Carbondale, Illinois, in San Antonio, in New Orleans, in El Paso. And the westbound journey, rather than picking up people from across the Atlantic world, is picking up people from across the Pacific world, really, or America's more explicitly colonized and colonial project. So it's gathering people from Mexico, but then also from China, Japan, the Philippines, South Asia, right? So you can see how the eastbound and the westbound journeys really demonstrate global migratory patterns from around the world, again, the Pacific and the Atlantic worlds, into the U.S., which is becoming, you know, by 1900, really the center of global racial capitalism.
Right. Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, this is a part of sort of this history of deportation is something I knew nothing about before I started reading the book. And so it's been really interesting to discover. Perhaps I think I should say the book is structured, as you say, about these kind of the trains stop in particular cities, and you have chapters, 13 substantive chapters that go through sort of that each sort of visits a particular sort of site and looks at a deportee, a guard, or other kind of historical characters, I suppose we might say, picked up at various sites. And I'm wondering, I think, yeah, could you give us an indication, just one quick empirical question, how long could people expect to spend on, could deportees expect to spend on a deportation train? And maybe very briefly, what kind of conditions, I mean, might deportees expect to experience?
Yeah. Well, the journey itself could vary. Maybe 9 days, maybe 7 to 9 days, coast to coast. The journeys themselves were aboard these Pullman tourister cars. And so, you know, when we think about deportation trains, you know, one of the first images that comes to mind are the Nazi cattle trains, right? This was very different than that. I mean, on the one hand, it was similar in that it had a similar project of ridding the nation of people who were considered polluted by these white supremacist, heteropatriarchal, imperial lands, whereas the Nazi regime was an explicitly murderous, necropolitical regime. The American one was it was a liberal democratic system structured by, you know, racial capitalism and cisgendered heteropatriarchy and ableist and all of these things too, but it wasn't explicitly murderous in the ways that the Nazi regime was. And so the trains, well, they experimented with different kind of architectures of trains. Sometimes they used a parlor car system that had various staterooms. And these actually kind of replicated, for, you know, our Foucauldian listeners, this replicated the cellular system that could break different kinds of category of people down into their own subset. So a diseased person could be in one room, and an anarchist in another room, and a criminal in another room, and then a merely poor woman and her child in another room. And there would be no quote unquote contagion among them. And so they experimented with this kind of system for a while, but then more often than that, as far as I can tell, they just use an open plan car. Or they would have a different kind of car. Some of the cars were more explicitly prison cars with bars across the windows. And this would be for supposedly more dangerous people who might have a criminal conviction, or for anarchists, or for Chinese who were considered almost to be an intrinsic escape risk by guards, apparently. But then sometimes they would have cars for people who were considered less dangerous, but who were considered more, you know, quote unquote, merely pathetic. So this would be people with disabilities, people, like I said, who were very, very poor and who were considered a drain on the welfare state and who weren't considered a flight risk. And so they could have the less securitized, less explicitly militarized cars on occasion for these people. So anyway, the journey was probably coast to coast, like I said, nine days or so, but people could have been detained for much, much longer periods before. So once somebody was swept into this broader, more coherent apparatus of capture, as I refer to it, they could languish in a jail, in a mental institution for years, for months or years, as their paperwork was being processed.
Right. Yeah. Those broader systems in view. Sorry, Ethan.
Not at all. Yeah, go ahead.
Thank you. That's really, really helpful. And I think, well, I was going to say, I think something you've started to get at here is the theoretical concepts. You mentioned, you know, necropolitics, right? And obviously eugenics has come up. And I know you do a really good job in early on in the book, and threaded, of course, throughout the book, of explaining certain key concepts that your book is anchored in. So, you know, I'm wondering if we could talk a bit about those key theoretical concepts, why they're important to you, and perhaps think as who influenced you in the course of writing the book too. So I know that you talk about racial capitalism as a key concept, settler colonialism, and also biopolitics, which, as you know, can be a kind of complicated sounding term. Doesn't necessarily have to be complicated to understand, but maybe our listeners could benefit from just a brief overview of what these concepts are and why they're important to your research here and to what you're outlining here. And I know you also draw on Du Bois throughout. If there's anyone else you'd like to sort of give a shout out to as sort of having influenced this, I'd be interested to hear.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, I guess the biggest concept, I think, that I'm drawing on is racial capitalism or global racial capitalism. And so that's the idea. Well, first of all, it's an insistence on the understanding that capitalism is always already structured and through racism and the reproduction of certain racial hierarchies and racial categories. And so it's a system through which the globe is partitioned into different areas and the people of the planet are partitioned into different categories in order to reproduce hierarchies, but then also especially to reproduce profits and profitability as a way of conceiving of spatial, political, racial, and biological organizations in the interest of profit making for capitalists. I mean, the Cedric Robinson is one of the real foundational theorists here. And then there's a lot of other folks who have been inspiring along the way. And global racial capitalism constitutes and subordinates people differently around the planet based around the particular conditions of exploitation, domination, the particular mode of production that's active in that particular moment and place. But everybody is subjected by it, even if people are subjected by it differently, through forms of hierarchy and through these forms of racial hierarchy. Now, because racial capitalism is interested in the reproduction of these systems through time and in the reproduction of biological and subordinated as well as elevated populations through time, gender is going to be a central feature of racial capitalist systems, right? So thinking about forms of sexual desire, forms of sexual reproduction, as these move through time. So gender is a foundational category to racial capitalism too. And then racial capitalism is useful also because it allows us to think in terms of scale. So you can think at the planetary scale, you can think at the national scale, you can think at the scale of the neighborhood, and you can think about the scale of the body, which I think is all very productive for how we understand the forms of differentiation, control, carcerality, imprisonment, and so on. So anyway, that's one of the big concepts. But then as we honed out a little bit, settler colonialism is another crucial category. And so this is the idea. Settler colonialism is different than extractive colonialism, as we understand it. They're both imperialist systems. They're both capitalist systems. Extractive colonialism is less about... Well, extractive colonialism is about sucking money from a system and drawing it into the metropole from elsewhere, whereas settler colonialism is about taking a people from one place and then trying to replace and eliminate or absorb indigenous peoples. And so the U.S. is a settler colonial country, Australia, where I am now, also a settler colonial country, Canada, New Zealand, South Africa, other kinds of settler, Anglophone settler colonial countries. Now, one of the things that's important to understand here is that the first order of business in a settler colony is to try to steal the land from indigenous peoples, right? And then render that land profitable by importing the people that the settlers want. Now, That's a crucial kind of insight. But where deportation comes into this is that deportation is, I argue, a second order process of settler colonialism, because it's about fundamentally regulating who gets to be a settler and who doesn't. And sort of the biological categories of who's invited and who isn't, who is welcome and who is not. And then this brings us into the idea of biopolitics, which is a fancy pants word, you know, coming out of the broadly Foucauldian tradition. But really what biopolitics I think can mean is the ways that government and as a mode of government that tries to control the biological reproduction of the population through time and to nurture and sustain its desired population and get rid of the populations it doesn't like. And so here's where the carceral welfare state and its deportation apparatus is really doing its ugly work. So it's in coming to define the people who are considered biologically unfit for reproduction and biologically unwelcome in the country. And so these are people with cognitive differences, people who are not neurotypical, people who are considered mad. And all of these categories change over time, right? There's no intrinsic definition of neurotypicality or madness. Same thing goes with ideas of sexual immorality, with ideas of criminality and political radicalism. And so all of these people are considered to be, when they're brought into this new and expansive apparatus of capture that I'm kind of talking about through the development of the system, this biopolitical integrated networked system, thanks to the train, is one of the things I argue, thanks to the growth of the telegraph and these new communication technologies, this creates a much more thoroughly integrated and networked carceral state based around expelling the so-called undesirable people.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Right. Great. That's a really excellent summary. Some pretty big concepts, but I think the way you link them together is very compelling as well. And of course, your choice of thinkers you draw upon helps with that. Okay, that's fantastic. Maybe we could move along to talk a bit about your choice of case studies, if you will, or people, really, who you looked at in the course of writing the book, because it's told through the stories of deportees as well as of guards and bureaucrats. And I think maybe a good way to start getting into that would be to zoom in on a particular case study or person. So perhaps we could go to chapter 11 on San Antonio, or rather Louis Moe, who boards in San Antonio, if you'd be willing to talk a bit.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Well, and so, I mean, I guess the way that I, yeah, so the book is structured around a composite train's journey. And so each chapter is a stop on the train's journey and tells the story of the individual people as they traveled from around the planet, you know, what drove them from China, what drove them from Ireland, what drove them from Mexico, what drove them from the Punjab, and then their particular experiences within a particular city in a particular place. And so, yeah, it's tracing the journeys through racial capitalism and into the American carceral state. Now, and I chose the people because I read many, many hundreds of the case files of folks who were loaded aboard the earliest deportation trains. I reconstructed the passenger lists from the earliest trains. And then I chose the people whose stories spoke to what I thought were the most interesting and important elements about how the deportation regime was defining undesirability, but then also that gave a good spread of global migratory routes and of cities along the way within the U.S. for the train's journey. And so, yeah, it's a kind of a spatial narrative that I employ. But anyway, yeah, so Louis Mo is from Guangdong. Some of the details of his story are a little bit fuzzy, but he leaves China. He may or may not have worked in Japan for a little bit. And then because of this is after the Chinese Exclusion Act, he can't get into the United States. Nevertheless, so he's excluded from the U.S., but like quite a large number of Chinese, he goes to Mexico. And Mexico, because Mexico has a much more open immigration policy in the late 19th century, because Mexico is itself trying to modernize under the Porfirato regime, and so is much more welcoming and much less anti-Asian than Americans are, than the U.S. is. So Louis Mo is one of these folks who then moves to Mexico, and he's living in Mexico until the Mexican Revolution starts. So then there's this radical expansion, actually, of anti-Chinese violence and anti-Chinese animus in Mexico during the Mexican Revolution, when a lot of anti-capitalist and Mexican nationalism, some gets directed towards the U.S., but a great deal of it gets directed, punching downward, as it were, against the Chinese and against Asians. And so there's a great deal of violence against Chinese. Then you've got Pancho Villa, who leads a raid into Columbus, New Mexico. And this is part of the complexity of the Mexican Revolution itself. This is a big battle. Pancho Villa then returns into Mexico. The U.S. then sends General Black Jack Pershing into Mexico in order to capture Pancho Villa. Now, the Mexican government isn't super supportive of this because they would be seen to be capitulating to the Leviathan to the north, and that would destabilize Mexican power. And so the U.S., so they don't have the infrastructural capacity, the U.S. Army and the Quartermaster Bureau doesn't have the infrastructural capacity to supply themselves. And so they wind up relying on Chinese Mexicans to do the fundamental infrastructural work of resupplying and supporting and fortifying the U.S. Army on its raids through Mexico trying to kill Pancho Villa. And Louis Mo is one of these people. And so General Black Jack Pershing, he does not capture or kill Pancho Villa. It's an abysmal failure. But one of the things that you actually see here is, quite interestingly, some of the origins of what becomes known as third country nationals. So the ways that the U.S. military in its overseas adventures relies on, say, people from the Philippines at their bases in Afghanistan, relies on people from the Philippines and their bases in Iraq. Anyway, this is the origin of that kind of third country national policy, or at least an early version of it, in that Louis Mo and the other Chinese folks were fundamental to this military practice. Anyway, the U.S. Army returns, they enter the United States, and Louis Mo and others know that they'll be killed, or that there's a likelihood that they'll be killed if they remain in Mexico. And so Pershing then makes lobbies in this kind of patronage sort of way to have Louis Mo and the other Chinese refugees return with him into the United States in contravention of the Chinese Exclusion Act. So they get special dispensation. There's more details to it. I've probably already gone longer than we've got time for. But Louis Mo winds up, along with the other Chinese refugees, being confined to working on American military bases because this is seen as a way of not competing with free white American workers if they're confined to military bases and doing military infrastructural work within the United States. But anyway, after a while, Louis Mo is arrested because he's stolen a little bit of money from the shop where he works. And he's then also, he gets in trouble because he's accused of flirting with a white woman. And in Texas, this is, you know, a very dangerous thing for a Chinese person to do. He then is eventually locked up in the Southwestern Insane Asylum and appears to be suffering from late stage syphilis. And through the records, talks about the experience of, first of all, his journeys through the world, around the world, but also his experience being locked up in the racially segregated Southwestern Insane Asylum in San Antonio. And he talks of his experiences and his visions, which are quite interesting in terms of looking at the perspectives of people who are considered mad, before he is eventually loaded on the deportation train, sent to San Francisco, then across the Pacific, and eventually to his, he's supposed to be sent to his uncle's shop on Winglock Street in Hong Kong. I don't know that he ever gets there. Because the records run out at that point.
Right. Okay. So yeah, clearly linked into much broader histories and stories, right? And yeah, nothing begins or ends with the deportation train or the deportation journey itself. I think that's something that you make very clear in all of these in all of these chapters, which are quite sort of sensitively written. I want to say, I don't know if you want to say anything about this, because I'm putting you on the spot a little bit here, but about the kind of the gender aspect, which we haven't talked so much about, in chapter 3, Portland, and of course elsewhere in the book, but especially here, you talk about how prostitution or sex work was sort of criminalized or sort of grounds for deportation and the experiences of sort of women who go through that. I wonder if you might be able to say something about that.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, so accusations of sexual immorality are really crucial here. And so this is, again, part of the biopolitics of this system and the notion of how to protect the white family and its reproduction across time and into the future. And so, I mean, part of the origins of the anti-Chinese movement was the accusation that Chinese women were prostitutes. And so the Page Act in 1875 is about stopping Chinese women from coming into the US. And the threat that the anti-immigrant folks saw was that, you know, these were a danger to, you know, healthy, white, masculine, patriarchal families that would be subverted by sex work and sexual immorality, quote unquote, sexual immorality. And so, yeah, the chapter in Portland really focuses on the delineation of kinds of sexual immoralities and differences. I focus on a woman who's a sex worker who is, as she explains, from Belgium. Germaine Monet is her name. She gets arrested in Portland, working in the kind of the red light district. And she actually winds up being able to trick immigration authorities by giving a false itinerary and a false name. And as a result, she's able to stay in the US for an additional 5 years. Now, her carceral experience is that she's locked up initially with a so-called rescue home, the Sisters of the Good Shepherd, I think it was called, in Portland. And these were institutions that were designed to, you know, quote unquote, rescue fallen women by teaching them to be good domestics and good mothers and good obedient wives, essentially. All of this was also in the context of the so-called white slave panics. And this was a series of moral panics around sexual immorality, but really about women who were unsupervised working in the city and away from patriarchal control, there's a lot more to it than that. I mean, it was a highly racialized, highly ethnically complicated set of processes. But nevertheless, this was a major panic going on in the early 20th century, too, that drove out a fair number of men and women who were accused of this kind of sexual immorality. I mean, one of the other people in Portland is a guy who he's a British guy, and he's accused of hitting on he's 20, 21, 22, I can't remember, but he's accused of sexually propositioning a young man at the YMCA. And so he also is considered beyond the pale of sexual immorality. He's has same-sex desire. And Portland and the Pacific Northwest was also at the same time in the midst of this anti-gay panic. And so he really fell afoul of this system too. And again, all of this is about the ways that gender and women's experiences, but then also experiences of sexual difference and homosexuality or alternative, you know, visions of sexuality would be criminalized. Because again, it threatened this heteropatriarchal family as was being seen as the foundation of the U.S. as the settler, as a settler state.
Right. Great. Thanks. Yeah. Yeah. Those intersections are very, sort of very clear in your writing. I think that's really helpful. Yeah. I wonder if we could pivot slightly to talk about who was behind these trains. So you said a little bit about, you know, Washington, broadly speaking, bureaucrats. I think it would be nice if we could talk a little bit about, you know, who were those sort of those bureaucrats, just in brief, who and where was coming up with this idea for the train and sort of refining it, and also who was working on the trains, you know, who are the guards? I mean, I'm also curious about, you know, immigration inspectors obviously turn up in the book enough to maybe warrant discussion. Who were these people? You do mention something interesting about sort of immigrants themselves becoming enforcers. And I wonder, some immigrants, that is, I wonder if that's something that we could discuss a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things, and I'm always very interested in who is the state and what is the state and how do we conceive of the state? Because it's not straightforward, and the state is not a monolith. And there are different battles and conflicts and struggles within it, as well as individual people. And so part of what I've tried to do here and then in another article that's kind of affiliated with the book is to look at the people who build the state, like who are the actual workers who do this and who make this. I mean, the state as a system is always more than the sum of its parts, but the laborers who build this infrastructure are crucial. Some of the main folks I look at one of the main folks I look at that I think is just a really interesting kind of tragic character is named Henry Weiss. And Henry Weiss his family is German. He's born in what was then called Constantinople. He moves to the US. He speaks something like seven languages. He's an enormously cosmopolitan person. He comes to the U.S., he marries, he moves to New York, he gets a job with the Immigration Bureau as a translator, and then moves across the country. He basically, from his personnel file, it gives every indication that he's basically maltreated, and other people with less skills than him seem to be getting promoted faster than he is. And there may be, you know, no shortage of ethnocentrism in his own experience. Nevertheless, he's a really hard worker. He's really ambitious. And it's pretty clear that he sees working for the Immigration Bureau is his path to upward mobility. This is his path to American belonging. And this is a very American story, right? You know, you work for the American state and you belong. more or less. You know, you certainly belong more than you would otherwise. And so Weiss eventually really makes his big break in the Bureau when authorities say, hey, this guy speaks seven languages. Let's send him through all of the, you know, insane asylums in Oregon to figure out who we can deport, and then we'll save some money. They realize he's good at this, and they put him in charge of running the first deportation trains. The next guy, and he's the main deportation agent for the next couple years. The next guy they hire is named Leo Russell, and he is an enormously talented clerk and bureaucrat. And he works his way up the system through filing and indexing correspondence. And this is the kind of thing that seems just crushingly boring and unimportant. But when you think about the creation of these complicated systems, filing and indexing correspondence is crucial because this is the production of bureaucracy itself. Right? The correspondence and the communication beyond the individual level, this is how bureaucracies work. And so this is fundamental to the creation of this kind of networked power. And so he works his way up the ranks. And he, like I say, he's enormously talented. He retires as a relatively young man and actually dies relatively young. Now he's replaced by a guy named Ed Klein. And Klein, according to his personnel records, is basically a slacker for much of his youth. He gets his jobs, as every indication shows, through nepotism. These are all white guys, by the way. Weiss is an immigrant, so he's on the edges of whiteness. Russell and then Klein are both, you know, they're unalloyed, considered to be unalloyed white people, white men. Anyway, Klein basically is not a particularly talented guy, but he's persistent. And he essentially, it's kind of, you know, to be a little bit flippant about it, he's by many appearances, a mediocre white man who works his way up through these systems through persistence, diligence, and some political acumen. And then he really finds his feet and then runs these deportation trains up through the Second World War. And in fact, he's celebrated by his colleagues upon retirement for his successfully using the trains to move Japanese Americans from the coast into Japanese internment camps during World War II. Yeah, so these are some of the main people who run the trains, but then there's also the private guards who work for Southern Pacific, who work for the Great Northern Railroad. And so these are private guards who are empowered by the state to have this fundamental policing function, including the exercise of violence. So private guards are in play here because of this partnership between the state and the private railroad firms. But then you've also got, you know, the guy who I kind of introduced the story with, Leo Stanley. You know, so there's a doctor who is aboard these trains too, to make sure that everybody is well enough on the train, so that they're well enough that they don't die, they're well enough that they're not disruptive. And so again, this is the difference between the Nazis and the Americans. The Americans don't want you to die on the train. What happens on the other side of the border? Not the Americans' problem. And so the doctor on the train is really there less to make sure that people are well than to make sure that the system doesn't get slowed down by illness, by other kinds of disruption.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. There's so much more I would like to ask about, especially the bureaucrats, since that's my area. Really interesting. Leo Russell, you know, one of the clerks you talked about, I thought it was really interesting that you said he also worked during World War One, right? For the Bureau of Naval Intelligence, and apparently did them a great service. Who knows what, but he did.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And so I was never able to track down those records, but he did great. And so this also shows the porousness between, you know, the domestic forms of control and the overseas military forms of control. And so scholars who work on the kind of the dialectic between domestic policing, domestic violence, and international policing and international violence, you know, this is precisely that kind of system. Well, yeah, these people show how there's not a line between the domestic, the exercise of control and violence and other kinds of control in the domestic realm, as well as international war fighting. So, there's very much of a feedback.
Yeah, you use the term, infrastructural power, right, which others have coined to sort of, connect these, I think, too. I think that's quite helpful as well. I wonder if we could move now to sort of talk about the borders being policed as part of this process. So, I mean, the US's main border of concern, I suppose, being the US-Mexico border, although the US-Canada border, of course, does feature in the book. But it might be good to talk about how the US-Mexico border sort of was functioning at this time, and maybe sort of bring us through to the present day a bit. I just wanted to mention one thing I found really interesting, and I had something I hadn't thought about, was and resonated with the more contemporary discussions about the environmental destruction involved in building sort of the border wall, right? Trump's border wall, was how you acknowledge the sort of the massive deforestation associated with building the railroads and the environmental impact. And so that's something that could maybe be sort of drawn out more. But anyways, that's a slight detour, but I thought that's something I thought was really interesting. But in general, what did the US-Mexico border look like at the time these trains were in operation? That might be an interesting something to explore. Yeah.
No, I'm glad you brought up the point about the massive deforestation and so on, because, a big part of this, the U.S. as a settler colony, is the radical transformation of the relationships between the human and the more than human world, and the commodification of everything, and transforming the more than human world, as well as humans, into abstract commodities who can then be profited from. so that's a key part of the conceptualization of the book, too. But in terms of what's going on at the Mexican, along the southern border, one of the things that scholars more recently have talked about is the complexity of the border, right? We sometimes imagine it, you know, in the Trumpian sense, as this hard wall that is just fundamentally designed to stop movement. But at the same time, we've got, as I was saying earlier, in the era of NAFTA and before and after, the border as selectively porous. And so capital and goods and commodities should be able to move across, but then people, you know, then that's a question mark for these, you know, capitalist nationalist systems. And so one of the things that I kind of explore in the book is based around two different groups of people's experiences. On the one hand, I talk about the experience of, in the Carbondale chapter, the experience of these Mexican track workers. And during World War I, the U.S. wants Mexican track workers to come into the country, even and they get kind of special provision because they're considered necessary wartime workers. Otherwise, they would have been excluded. So for these families, for these Mexican track worker families who do tons of infrastructural work around the country, but particularly in the West, the border for them is relatively porous. They can cross the border in order to render vital services to the country as long as they never run afoul of the law, and as long as their labor is still considered desirable. And I tell the story of these two brothers, one of whom is considered mad and is also incarcerated in in St. Joseph, Missouri, through a very interesting and weird set of processes and people who bring him into the system, who we don't need to get into at the moment. But in any case, because he is considered mad, he and his brother get deported because they are no longer profitable, welcome people. And so they demonstrate the border as kind of porous infrastructure, so long as you don't do anything that gets you in trouble. But then the other story I tell is of these Japanese men who leave Japan. They then travel to Peru. They live through Peruvian comprador capitalism and so-called coolie exploitation. They become seamen and travel through and travel around sort of the British maritime networks along the Pacific coast of South America. Before they go to Mexico, they find similar kinds of anti-Asian violence that we talked about with Louis Moe. But in any case, they're working in Tampico, which is a center of the Mexican as well as British and increasingly American oil industries, before they decide that Tampico is no longer viable for them. And they then move up through Mexico and then try to enter the United States. They get caught trying to sneak across the border outside of El Paso. The U.S. Mexico or the Border Patrol had not yet been formally instituted yet. The Border Patrol is developed in 1924, and so this is a little bit before that. But there had been Chinese inspectors and customs officers who were particularly geared towards capturing Chinese migrants, and so these guys get caught trying to sneak across the border. I mean, the hard lesson that they learn is that if you're going to try to get across the U.S.-Mexico border as it's increasingly policed, you can't really do it on your own. You need to hire a smuggler. You need to hire a professional because they know the ways through. Nevertheless, their experience is not of the border as selective, the selective porousness of the border, but this is a hard border. This is a militarized border. This is a border where you can get shot, which was different than the Mexican track workers' experience. Yeah, so you can see both of these things really forming at the time.
Right. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Okay. Yeah. So differential experiences of the border.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. Okay. Thank you. Yeah, I think that's a really crucial insight. The nature of the border and which sort of continues, of course, to this day, right? I mean, I don't know if you'd like to say anything about how the book sort of connects to contemporary happenings at the border. I mean, obviously, yeah, this fantasy of the border as a hard, sort of just a hard wall, a boundary, is something that we can unpack through the book. Any other sort of points of resonance that might be worth contemplating?
Yeah, well, I think, so just getting back to the ideas of biopolitics and necropolitics, these always work together, right? The biopolitical is always founded upon the necropolitical. The necropolitical being bloody, racist violence. Not always racist, but yes. Anyway, so the fundamental violence upon which modern states are built can be considered necropolitical violence because it's based around ultimately killing people. One of the arguments I try to make in the book is that the deportation system effectively sublimates the necropolitical violence of the previous deportation systems, which tended, as I said, to be much more violent, much bloodier, more locally based, and it systematizes it and spatializes it. You know, it turns the necropolitical violence into spatial control and spatial distribution. So it sublimates that kind of violence into spatial distribution. Now, there's still kinds of spasmodic eruptions of violence, of anti-immigrant violence across the 20th century, in the 1930s, in all sorts of other localized anti-immigrant necropolitical violences. But one of the things that I try to do, because I was finishing the book in the era of Trump, First of all, the book was trying to historicize the growth of mass deportation, writ large. My first book, just backing up a bit, was trying to historicize the emergence of mass incarceration. This one trying to historicize mass deportation as two related processes. Nevertheless, part of my argument is that, Obama and Clinton and George W. Bush were massive deporters of people. They also oversaw massive incarceration and mass deportation. But one of the things that I think drove the emergence of Trump's base and their mobilization was the idea that this sublimated violence of spatial removal didn't satisfy the kind of racial catharsis that previous forms of anti-immigrant violence had satisfied. And so the overperformances of this violence, saying that, got to take the gloves off, or the other kinds of metaphors of like, we're really going to let the immigration, the border patrol do their thing. All of this was a call to that kind of cathartic racial violence that I think is really central to so much of American history, at least as a major strand of American history, as a settler invader colony that is trying to restrict who gets to be a settler and who doesn't. And so I think that was a real source of Trump's appeal, and it continues to be in these kind of far right politics. The spatial removal of the Democrats wasn't adequate to scratch that itch in this era of late capitalist neoliberal anxiety.
Right. Thanks. Yeah, that's a really good, bringing us through to the present day. I really appreciate that. That contextualization. Thank you for that. I think as we're approaching an hour now of interviewing, so applauding your stamina here, I would like to ask, what's next for you? Or, what are you working on now or planning to work on? If you'd like to say any more, maybe it connects to the book, maybe it doesn't. I think I'd love to hear about that.
Sure. I've got a few things that I'm thinking about. I've been doing work with a group called the First Nation Deaths in Custody Watch Committee, which is a Aboriginal-led group of folks that are trying to have not so many First Nations people get killed in police custody in Western Australia. I've been doing some work with them for the last 10 years or so, and so trying to do some more writing about and on behalf of the Watch Committee. There's a possible project around a global history of Japanese internment camps that I am involved in as well. And there's some other stuff that is en route too. And we'll see where that goes. Yeah, it's all pretty heavy stuff to be writing about. But I think, in order to understand, we got to understand how the world got to be the way that it is, in order to imagine how we might be able to make the world a little bit better. So that's where I'm coming at this from.
Absolutely. Right. Yep. That's the critical scholar's task, right? Thank you for doing that. I think that's a good place for us to end. So this has been Catriona Gold speaking with Ethan Blue, who is the author of the fascinating new book, The Deportation Express, A History of America Through Forced Removal, released in October 2021 with the University of California Press. If you'd like to pick up a copy, please consider ordering directly from UC Press or supporting your local bookstore. Friends, don't let friends buy from Amazon. Thank you all for tuning in to the New Books Network, and thanks again for joining me, Ethan.
Thank you.